ورحمة الله وبركاته.
Headlines this hour. Iraqi protesters call for the expulsion of American forces as they mark the anniversary of the U.S. assassination of top Iranian and Iraqi anti-terror commanders. Iran says it has informed the U.N. nuclear watchdog of its plan to enrich uranium up to 20% purity to comply with a recently passed legal act. And new footage shows an unarmed African-American man who was recently killed by police in the U.S. city of Columbus received no medical attention after being hit. Well, welcome to our studios in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Iraqis have hit the streets of the capital, Baghdad, to mark the first anniversary of the U.S. assassination of top Iranian General Qasem Soleimani and the Iraqi commander, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. The protesters marched in the city mourning the deaths of Soleimani and Muhandis while carrying their pictures and banners. They also chanted slogans demanding the expulsion of U.S. forces from the country and the revenge for the killings. General Soleimani and Muhandis were assassinated in Baghdad in a U.S. drone strike ordered by President Donald Trump in January of last year. Iraq has planned to hold events throughout the first week of January, including a protest at the site of the attack. Iran has once again condemned the U.S. for murdering its top General Qasem Soleimani, vowing to prosecute those involved in the assassination. In a tweet, Iran's foreign ministry said that Washington's terrorist act was a blatant violation of international law, the U.N. Charter, and Iraq's sovereignty. It said the Islamic Republic will not rest until bringing those responsible to justice. Meanwhile, the chief commander of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps warned the U.S. against any provocative moves in the Persian Gulf. Major General Hossein Salami emphasized that Iran stands fully prepared for any possible scenario. Salami was speaking at a ceremony marking the first anniversary of the assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. Senior Iranian officials and foreign delegates participated in the ceremony in the capital, Tehran.
Iran has marked the first anniversary of the U.S. assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and Iraq's PMU commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. The ceremony was attended by a small group of people from all walks of life and senior officials due to anti-COVID health protocols. Addressing the ceremony, Iran's judiciary chief Ayatollah Raisi has warned the enemies should await Iran's harsh revenge for the killing of Iran's top general Qasem Soleimani. Ayatollah Raisi also said the assassination of anti-terror commander Soleimani will fail to undermine the resistance front.
By assassinating the hero of the fight against terrorism in the region and the world, the creators of Daesh and Al-Qaeda imagined that the resistance front would become weak. But they are wrong. The resistance front will never lose its strength. The assassination of General Soleimani has injected fresh energy into the spirit of resistance among people of the region.
Moreover, head of the Quds Force of the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps, Brigadier General Ismail Ghani, said Soleimani was the hero of defeating arrogance.
General Soleimani was the man of resistance and logic. His path will continue. Those who assassinated him should be prepared for harsh revenge. General Soleimani was the hero of defeating arrogance. He is the hero of the Iranian nation and a hero of the Islamic Ummah.
A number of foreign dignitaries, including senior officials from Islamic Jihad, Iraq's Hashd al-Shaabi, and Lebanese Hezbollah, as well as Yemeni ambassador, were among the participants at this event, who talked about different aspects of the personality of General Qasem Soleimani. One of the foreign dignitaries who attended the ceremony was Hashem Safieddin, senior official of Lebanese Hezbollah, who said the resistance movement should continue the path of Soleimani. He also noted General Soleimani and assassinated Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis protected the world against the Daesh terror group. General Soleimani, former commander of the IRGC Quds Force, was killed in a U.S. drone attack in Iraq on January 3, 2020. On the first martyrdom anniversary of General Qasem Soleimani, senior Iranian officials have once again vowed to bring to justice the main perpetrators of his assassination in due time. According to Iranian officials, a lawsuit which has been filed in Iran against the U.S. for assassinating General Qasem Soleimani is in its final stage. And soon, a court session will be held in this regard. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has expressed condolences over the passing away of senior Iranian cleric Ayatollah Mohammad Taghi Mesbahyazdi. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said the death of Ayatollah Mesbahyazdi is a loss to Iran's Islamic seminary. The leader described the late clergyman as an outstanding thinker who taught brilliant students. Other senior officials, including President Hassan Rouhani and Parliament Speaker Mohammad Bagher Alibaf, also sent their condolences over Ayatollah Mesbahyazdi's demise.
Ayatollah Mesbahyazdi passed away on Friday after a period of hospitalization in the Iranian capital, Tehran, due to gastrointestinal problems. The late Ayatollah was receiving treatment since nearly a month ago and was hospitalized after his condition worsened. Ayatollah Mesbahyazdi, a cleric and political theorist, is survived by his work as a veteran politician and his role in expanding seminary education in Iran. The late Ayatollah was born in the central city of Yazd on January 31, 1935. He had his initial seminary education in his hometown before moving to the city of Qom, where he studied under the late founding father of the Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini, as well as Grand Ayatollah Hussein Burujerdi and Ayatollah Muhammad Hussein Tabatabai. In time with his religious studies, Mesbahyazdi played a key role in Imam Khomeini's uprising against the regime of former Iranian monarch Mohammad Reza Pahlavi. The late Ayatollah was part of the secret 11-member group, which was formed in 1965 to fight the regime and was involved in the distribution of revolutionary pamphlets against the monarch. But Mesbahyazdi left his imprint in Iran after the Islamic Revolution of 1979, which overthrew the Pahlavi regime. He served four terms as a member of the powerful Assembly of Experts, the body of veteran clerics charged with electing the leader of the Islamic Revolution since 1990. The late Ayatollah was also a member of the Front of the Islamic Revolution Stability, a principalist political party which was formed in 2011. Mesbahyazdi was also actively involved in the seminary education of clerics in the post-revolutionary era. He was a member of the respected Society of Teachers of Qom Seminary all along. As a faqih, literally an expert in Islamic law, he founded the Baghir al-Ulum Cultural Institute in 1984 to promote seminary students' level of political knowledge with regard to the Islamic world, Iran, and international relations. Mesbahyazdi also founded the Imam Khomeini Educational Research Institute. He headed the institute, which is one of the largest seminaries in the city of Qom, for over 25 years.
Iran has notified the International Atomic Energy Agency about its plan to enrich uranium up to 20% purity level. Head of Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, Ali Akbar Salahi, says the Islamic Republic has sent a letter to the IAEA regarding its decision. He said that the move has been approved by Parliament. He did not state exactly when the enrichment activity would begin, but said that he is awaiting the President's order. Last month, the Iranian Parliament passed a law dubbed the Strategic Action Plan to counter sanctions. It calls on the government to produce at least 120 kilograms of 20% enriched uranium annually and to store it inside the country within 2 months after the adoption of the law. New footage indicates that an unarmed African-American man who was fatally shot by police last week in the U.S. city of Columbus received no medical attention after being hit. The video taken from a body cam of an officer at the scene shows the victim, Andre Hill, lying on the ground for several minutes without any aid. The footage also shows a woman saying Hill has just brought her money. The 47-year-old was shot to death on December the 22nd by a Columbus officer, Adam Coy. The shooting came after neighbors made a non-emergency call about someone starting and stopping a car. Hill's death marks the second fatal shooting of an African-American by Columbus police in a month. The city's authorities have promised a thorough investigation into the shooting. Political commentator Gloria Estela Larriva says that impunity for law enforcement agencies in the U.S. must come to an end.
This is one more example of how a man in a friend's house is shot just because the police show up. With a camera, the body camera off, that was very deliberate, not finding out what was going on, gun drawn, and then just shooting. And again, as you said, it was the second shooting in 1 month. And the only way that it can even begin to be addressed for justice and to stop the killings is for these police to be arrested right away. Firing him after days and days, that's not enough. They must be charged with murder. Because when the police have the gun, they're supposed to be the ones who are more careful. And again, there's just too many. And it's to be black in America is very dangerous.
Time now for the news review of this bulletin. Hello, welcome to the news review. Israeli forces have shot a Palestinian man in the neck after he tried to prevent them from forcefully confiscating his electric generator. The Palestinian Health Ministry said 24-year-old Haroun Razmi Abu Aram has been paralyzed from the neck down. Israeli forces shot the unarmed man from close range in a village south of Al-Khalil, also known as Hebron, in the occupied West Bank. Israeli troops frequently shoot with impunity at Palestinians who resist the regime's arbitrary land grabs, the seizure of properties, and detention. The violence leaves many Palestinians dead or injured every year. Monica Neal is a correspondent joining us from occupied Ramallah. We also have Jamal Juma, head of the Stop the Wall campaign, also joining us from occupied Ramallah. Well, Mona, this is a very distressing video that we witnessed, and it's quite sad how this story went down. Tell us more about the fate of this person who, from what we understand, is now paralyzed.
That's right. According to the Palestinian Ministry of Health, he's suffering serious condition. This 24-year-old Palestinian, Haroun Abu Aram. The incident happened in the village of Twani in Masafer Yatta in the southern occupied West Bank city of Al-Khalil, also known as Hebron. As the video shows, this Palestinian man was barefoot, crippled by the soldiers. He was trying to defend his land and face the soldiers. The area is continuously attacked by the soldiers, the Israeli military, who insist to force the people out of their areas in order to confiscate the lands and annex it to numerous settlements around these areas. The Palestinian Ministry of Foreign Affairs slammed the incident, condemned it, and considered it as a crime, calling for immediate intervention from the international community to force the Israelis to stop the illegal practices and the crimes committed against the Palestinians all over the occupied West Bank, not only in areas adjacent to the illegal settlements or in Area C.
Okay, General Juma, you know, it's quite shocking, obviously, to see how this man got shot at by Israeli forces. But, of course, this pretty much is one example of the many atrocities that happens in the occupied territories. And we know that this type of action by the Israeli forces is maybe indirectly supported by the United States. How is it that Israel, almost without any world condemnation, is continuing with these types of actions?
And first of all, this shows, you know, what do the Palestinians face in the West Bank. These people are dehumanizing the Palestinians. You don't deal with them as a human beings. With this, with poor man who's trying to get back his generator, electrical generator, he has been shot from zero distance and by a soldier. And he just left, go home, like if he did nothing. Like, this is how they deal with the Palestinians. This is the daily fight of the Palestinians in the occupied Palestinian areas to keep their land, to keep their dignity, to keep the future, their future on their land. Because what's happening in the south of Hebron Hills, this is ongoing targeting these people, trying to push them out from that area to be expanded for the settlements and to be confiscated for the settlers' privilege. The main shortages or lack versus all this is that the accountability. That Israel, when they do these crimes constantly and continuously in the West Bank, they know that there is no consequences on them for that. There is no international law that can take them to international criminal courts, and they know that they will not pay any price for that because they have been backed by by the biggest imperialist power in the world, which is the United States, which they're backing them up. And even more this year, that they show their face where they, no matter what they are doing to the Palestinian people, at the end, this land is not for the indigenous Palestinian people. It's for this criminal settlers who came from all over the world and occupied Palestinian land. So this is the dilemma that we are living in, that there is no real international system that can victory for the oppressed people like the Palestinian people. So easily a power like this, like anyway, they are a criminal state, racist state, that they dehumanizing the people, they can really escape with all the crimes that they are doing. In fact, what we need in order to make this they're accountable, it has to be a real Islamic, Arab, international solidarity with the Palestinian people and ready to take their responsibility into make Israel pay for this crime by isolating them, by boycotting them, by putting pressure on Europe and the United States. That is not acceptable in the 21st century, that would and a state would behave like this against innocent people who as unarmed people, civilian people, that they are maximum what they want is to keep their dignity, to what they are struggling for their freedom in their own land.
Well, Mona, maybe you can tell us. I'm guessing that this video, if it hasn't gone viral at this point, that it may, based on obviously the graphic way that this incident happened. Can you please tell us how this is being received by the Palestinians in the occupied West Bank, and what types of reactions perhaps you have heard from about this so far?
Well, every day this keeps reminding the Palestinians, such incidents keeps reminding the Palestinians that they are living under occupation, that the Israeli army and the Israeli authorities continue to practice the most illegal practices, atrocities, the crimes against them, and that they have nothing now but to be adherent to the only choice that is resistance, because in recent weeks Palestinians were suffering from non-stop aggression by the Israeli settlers, supported and backed up by the Israeli military. Today, this incident and the video that went viral, it's the Israeli soldiers themselves attacking unarmed Palestinians, shooting him. It's a crime against all laws, mainly humanitarian laws. This is painful for the Palestinians. That's why they are urging the attention from the international community, from the Arab world, the Islamic world. And the most important is to remain united in facing and fighting the Israeli occupation.
Thank you very much for that. Mona Kandil, a correspondent from Occupied Ramallah, also Jamal Juma, thank you. Head at the Stop the Wall campaign, also from Occupied Ramallah. Many thanks. And that does it for our news review. Thanks for tuning in. And that is for this edition of World News. It's bye-bye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. all produced by IRIB English Radio.
Aperture.
At the height of the Cold War, the CIA launches a highly classified, top-secret research program into the covert use of biological and chemical agents. In simulated attacks on enemy populations, entire cities throughout America are contaminated with bacteria, exposing millions of Americans to germ warfare. But the real focus of the research is on mastering the art of mind control. I'm Daniel Arya, and this is Aperture. LSD had become one of the CIA's key interests for its brain warfare program. As the agency theorized, it could be useful in interrogations. Mind control experiments generally centered around behavior modification via electroshock therapy, hypnosis, polygraphs, radiation, and a variety of drugs, toxins, and chemicals. Now, these experiments relied on a range of test subjects, some who freely volunteered, some who volunteered under coercion, and some who had absolutely no idea that they're involved in a sweeping defense research program. And what was the extent of these brainwashing experiments? How did the CIA use unconsenting people as guinea pigs in thousands of different experiments? Join us on Aperture for your answers on CIA covert experiments.
August 16th, 1951. Madness spreads through the village of Pont-Saint-Esprit in the Gard region in France. Dozens of villagers have been victim of these bouts of madness. The press describes men terrorized by snakes swirling in their stomachs. A doctor recounts the evening of the 25th of August, where dozens of locals were seized by convulsions, like in a night of the apocalypse. Reports from the victims are terrifying. Pont Saint-Esprit, they call it the cursed bread drama, because all of those who fell ill ate the bread from the Brion bakery. It's the first time in France that a whole village has gone mad. It made headlines in the press, who wondered what could have caused this collective hallucination. In Pont Saint-Esprit, the locals panic, and nobody will touch the bread. The hearses quickly arrive in the village. In total, 7 deaths, 300 people poisoned, and around 50 admitted to psychiatric wards. The first dead were buried. The investigators initially thought it was a return of St. Anthony's fire, a disease that killed many thousands in the Middle Ages, caused by a parasitic ergo fungus that attacks cereals. The baker was accused of poisoning, then the miller. Arrested and incarcerated, they were released after several months. They say that their confessions were made under duress, and above all, the evidence proved their innocence. It was then thought to be water poisoning, mercury, fertilizers, or a nearby gas factory. But the evidence disapproved these theories one by one. Since then, in Pont Saint-Esprit, more far-fetched theories have surfaced. Nothing is clear, and for decades the incident goes unexplained. But against all expectations, 60 years later, a new theory is proposed. Not from France, but from the United States. An American researcher in the Secret Services, Hank Albarelli, is investigating the suspicious death of a biochemist from the CIA, Frank Olson. A specialist in chemical weapons, he carried out experiments on hard drugs like LSD. He was also in France a few months before the Pont Saint-Esprit incident. Afterwards, he kept sinking into depression, telling his wife that he'd made a terrible mistake. Hank Albarelli then made the link with the Pont Saint-Esprit incident. Could it have been the CIA and the American Army spraying LSD onto the bread?
I have no doubt at all that Pont Saint-Esprit was a U.S. Army covert experiment. Initially, I had doubts, and I think initially my doubts were motivated by wishful thinking on my part, where I didn't want it to be an experiment. It was hard to fathom the government doing that. Although at the same time, there were a number of research tracks that were being conducted for the book at the same time. So my being naive about what the government and the U.S. Army was capable of doing was the threshold for that was dwindling.
Is it possible that the Americans drugged an entire village in an ally country, causing, no doubt accidentally, the death of 7 people? Improbable. However, to understand what happened in Pont Saint-Esprit, we need to look back at the end of the Second World War, when the level of atrocities committed by the Nazis was discovered in the camps. Notably, horrific experiments carried out on thousands of prisoners by chemists or doctors. Men lacerated, poisoned, burnt alive, exposed to radiation. The Allies hunted the war criminals from Hitler's regime. In 1946 in Nuremberg, the doctors are put on trial. 22 men and one woman who experimented on human beings, who they transformed into lab rats, stand accused. The trial sets a precedent. 7 of the accused are sentenced to death, 11 given prison sentences, and 5 are acquitted. As a result, the Americans draft the Nuremberg Code, a model which gives strict rules for experimenting on humans, notably the voluntary consent of the human subject is absolutely essential. The experiment must be designed to avoid all unnecessary suffering, physical and mental harm. With the Nuremberg trial barely over, the winners remain cynical. The American Secret Service begins Operation Paperclip. Nearly 1,500 German scientists, including war criminals, are expatriated to America. They are offered a new life in exchange for their knowledge and cooperation.
It was a very serious game of propaganda that we were playing. It was almost a show trial. We're putting the Nazis on trial, but in fact, behind the curtain, we're doing some very nasty things ourselves to basically incarcerated people, poor people, individuals who at the time were called feeble-minded and locked up in institutions. And if you were in one of those institutions, whether you were indigent or an unwed mother or had some sort of mental incapacity, there's a good chance that you may have been incorporated in some sort of medical study, possibly for the government or not, where you would have been used and abused.
Assisted by the German scientists, the Americans begin pursuing their goal of the ultimate weapon, and everything is allowed in the name of the Cold War. On the one side was the Army, whose priority is to win the nuclear arms race. At the time, to test the effects of radiation on a large scale, they used their own soldiers, who were docile and disciplined. Between 1946 and 1962, between 250,000 and 500,000 men were exposed to radiation on Bikini Atoll or in the Nevada desert. They were exposed with no protection, unaware of the risks involved. And afterwards, the radiated particles were cleaned up with brooms.
How about radiation? You think there's much danger from radiation?
Well, radiation is the least of the worries that the men are thinking about.
I think most people thought that radiation was the greatest danger, didn't they? Where did they learn different?
Well, prior to our instructions here, we received a very thorough briefing before we even came in this close to contact with it.
On the other side was the CIA, who was above all interested in psychological manipulation. Their goal was to create an infallible truth serum, wipe memories, turn humans into robots, and program them to kill. Conveniently, in 1948, a researcher in the Sandoz laboratories, Albert Hoffman, discovers a molecule that ignites the Secret Service, lysergic acid diethylamide, or LSD. It's derived from the same rye fungus, long held responsible for the incident at Pont Saint-Esprit. It was believed that the hallucinogenic properties of this drug were key to psychological manipulation. Fearing that the Russians would get their hands on Sandoz's samples, the Americans bought all of their stock. The discovery of LSD was a godsend for the Army, who on the brink of nuclear weapons were looking for a weapon that could defeat an enemy without firing any weapons. The man who was head of this program longest was James Ketchum, shown here in uniform. He was a psychiatrist who was working for the military. As a patriot, he was prepared to push the boundaries in his research. He tested around 30 drugs, but especially LSD and the dangerous benzylate. He treated 7,000 soldiers, hundreds of whom later sued the Army because of the side effects that they still experience and attribute to these drugs. However, when questioned, James Ketchum sees things differently.
I think they were very patriotic. They've not been given credit. They've been called innocent guinea pigs, which they certainly were not. They knew what they were doing, and we told them as much as we could about it. We had to limit the names of the drugs because some of them were artificially made, and if we were to give out the name, of course, that would also reveal the structure, and that we were afraid the Russians would get that. They were apparently following our work. We thought they were ahead of us, but actually they weren't, and so they were watching what we did to see what they could learn and use, and they developed a similar drug later themselves.
In parallel with the Army, the CIA was also developing its own programs, codenamed Bluebird, Artichoke, and later MKUltra. But to carry out these programs on a large scale, they needed funds. In 1950, the Korean War gave them the ideal pretext. Some American soldiers were captured. Detention, pilots admitted having dropped chemical weapons onto Korea, which was forbidden. The Americans claimed this was due to psychological manipulation, and the CIA took advantage of this godsend to obtain budgets that allowed them to work on brainwashing.
During the Korean War, the American pilots who were captured started making apparently false confessions of germ warfare. The first question is, was it really false confessions? But then when they were brought back to the United States, the military and the military psychiatrists studied them and decided that there's mind control operations being run against Americans. So for defensive purposes, we had to study this, figure it out, therefore we created MKUltra. Before MKUltra was Bluebird and Artichoke. So the whole rationale is it's defensive. It's because of what the communists are doing. Problem is, the Korean War started in June 1950, and Bluebird was signed into operation by the head of the CIA in April 1950.
In the Edgewood camp where James Ketchum worked, soldiers are called upon more and more. They think they're testing gas masks. In reality, the canisters are filled with a toxic chemical.
They were testing a whole assortment of different hallucinogens like LSD and marijuana and things like that. And they explored other drugs, very high levels of atropine, scopolamine, benzolates, very powerful. And a lot of these soldiers ended up incapacitated. It took them a long time to recover. And while they're in recovery, the doctors cannot do any more experiments because it's basically a very small base and testing operation. In other words, they needed a new site.
It's in this context of the Cold War and secret agents that on the 16th of August, 1951, the tragedy at Pont Saint-Esprit unfolded. France was suffering economically, and the Americans distrusted this ally they couldn't control. The village was under the control of socialists at the time. In the eyes of America, they were Reds, the epitome of the Soviet danger. But the mayor, Roger Castillon, doesn't believe in a foreign conspiracy. Yet American experts like Colin Ross are much more down to earth.
Obviously, that compound didn't just come in the rain, or just wasn't sitting around naturally. It was obviously organized, controlled, distributed. So whether it was actually LSD or some other compound doesn't make that much difference. Pont Saint-Esprit is actually not just this happened once in the world in a village in France. It's consistent with all the other experiments on the public that have done in the United States and done for a documented fact.
To achieve their goals, would the Americans be prepared to use a whole village as a laboratory? After all, these are civilians, not trained soldiers. However, in September 1950, nearly 1 year before Pont Saint-Esprit, this is exactly what they did, and in their own country. Off the coast of San Francisco, the American Marines were carrying out military maneuvers. A ship approached the coast and bombarded the city with a bacteria causing nucosomia, Serratia marcescens. The military were testing the effects of spraying this through the air. This classified secret defense map shows the scale of the targeted area. At least 11 people were hospitalized, one of whom died of pneumonia. The villagers wonder why a supposedly festive drug that is loved by hippies would have had such terrifying effects at Pont Saint-Esprit. James Ketchum, the military psychiatrist who specialized in LSD, a little reluctantly, admits that the drug is scary for those who take it unknowingly.
Some individuals could have a bad trip if someone gave them LSD and didn't tell them about it. That's very anxiety-producing. Or if they were inexperienced and not particularly well-balanced themselves, took a fairly large dose of LSD, they could have a bad trip. How would you feel if you had a cup of coffee and started to see things going like this or like this, or brilliant colors appear on the ceiling, or suddenly you felt you're out of your body and looking down on yourself? These are all things that can happen with LSD.
But can these effects have a delayed onset?
In Pont Saint-Esprit, the older generation will remember the night of the apocalypse, where dozens of men went mad and were sectioned in a psychiatric unit because of terrifying visions. This night took place more than 2 weeks after the cursed bread was consumed. But again, James Ketchum admits that it's possible.
Some individuals had flashbacks later in which they would go into a situation where they had been when they were taking LSD and have a flood of the same emotions and some of them anxiety producing.
In 1951, French investigators also consider LSD and call upon Albert Hoffman, inventor of the drug. On the spot, he tells the investigators that he has no doubt that the hallucinations were due to LSD. But after returning to Switzerland, he backtracks, claiming he was mistaken. The French want explanations, but public health documents from 1951 show that the expert became suddenly unreachable. We are sorry that the eminent professor has not been able to get back in touch with us.
I would think if the Sandoz scientists are saying it doesn't seem to be LSD, they're just trying to cover up the fact that it's 100% for sure that LSD must have come from Sandoz, because they were the only suppliers. It's nothing more than a cover-up.
After months of inquiry, the French investigators were so disoriented by the number of fruitless leads that the incident at Pont Saint-Esprit falls victim to its own mystery. During this time, the experiments continued in the United States, and they reached a level never seen before in any country, including the Soviet bloc.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, brothers and sisters. Thank you so very much for joining us on today's episode of The Lantern. As always, it's a pleasure and honor to have a share of a few moments of your day as we reflect upon the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt alayhimus salam in the form of everyday stories, stories regarding great personalities and figures, anecdotes, analogies. Because at the end of the day, we do what we can in order to find a glimpse of the light of truth in our lives. The story we're going to be discussing today is very similar to that of Nabi Ayyub alayhi salam, which we've talked about on our show, I think, on several occasions. So let's listen to the story real quick, and we'll see how this story is similar to that of the Prophet of God.
In the name of Allah, dear friends, so welcome to this program, Lantern. Today's story is entitled Feeling Pleased with Whatever Pleases Allah. One of the students of Sheikh Behjat, the great scholar, says, "One day I went to the house of Sheikh Behjat a few minutes before the start of the class, because often the Sheikh used to attend the classroom and he would narrate a story or a tradition or a moral lesson till all the students attend. Luckily, as I entered, he came to the room early and said this to me after the greeting and the salutation. In the city of Najaf, a handsome Iranian youth was with us from the people of Hamadan, and he was famous for being neat and physically well-formed. One day, this youth became paralyzed to the extent he could not walk except after leaning on a cane. I tried not to meet him due to his particular condition. Therefore, I used to avoid meeting him so I would not add one more grief to his griefs. One day, I got out of the alley and saw him standing in the street, so I had no choice except to meet him. Without contemplating, I asked him, 'How do you feel?' But I was upset with having said so and kept saying this to myself, 'What empty talk is this? Do you not see in what condition he is?' But contrary to my expectation, when he opened his mouth to answer my question, his speech was like cool water with which he put out what I had felt inside. He kept praising and thanking Allah with a spirit filled with activity and pleasure, as if he was drowned in blessings of Allah, the praise and the most exalted one. I felt relieved and my grief departed from me."
The Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
The story was regarding Ayatollah Behjet. Now, I don't personally know about the trials and turbulences and obstacles and difficulties Ayatollah Behjet went through in his life, though I'm pretty sure they weren't little, because anyone who gets anywhere in life has gotten through that, has gotten there through trials and tests from Allah. And it is through those trials and tests that a man's true measure is revealed, and for ourselves, most and foremost, because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala already knows the quality of his servants and what they're made of, the extent of their spirit, their capacity. But if he does put us through tests, the tests are so that we prove something to ourselves, whether we can power through a certain situation, whether we can fight the obstacles, we can fight those battles, and we can stand tall at the end and step out of that storm as a better person. It all comes down to how we weather the storms of life. So the story was about a man who was known among his peers and his classmates as being very well dressed and, you know, being handsome and good looking and whatever. Some people are like that. Aside from being well dressed, you know, they have that thing going on with their natural appearance that is attractive, that looks, everything looks so well proportioned. And he was one of those individuals. And his test, ironically or naturally enough, was that he would be paralyzed, and which is something that we really need to focus on at some point as well. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, you know, it seems that you get what you hate. That's what we usually talk, that's how we see it as, you know, simple-minded human beings. But from Allah's perspective, not that I am a professional at understanding Allah's perspective, but from what it seems is that you really do get what you hate, because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wants you to grow out of that. We are so keen on remaining in our comfort zones, but what we don't understand is that, as cliche as it may sound, unless we step out of that comfort zone, there is not going to be any growth for us. A child who learns how to ride the bike for the first time isn't feeling comfortable. A child who is weaned from his mother's, their mother's breast milk isn't comfortable. A child who is potty training isn't comfortable. I'm not comparing ourselves to a toddler, but I kind of am, because the foundation of our growth is set from our childhood. And by putting us through that process, it's like Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wants to tell us that this is the condition to your growth. You have to step out of your comfort zone. You have to experiment things that you didn't even imagine you could do. A child cannot imagine themselves not living a single day without their mother's milk or without being able to go potty anywhere, anytime. The process of having to step into another room to do their business is so alien to them. When we grow up, sure, our lives become much, much, much like a million times more complicated than the process of, you know, call of nature. But the idea, the system is still the same, even if the scenario changes. So basically, through blessings, Allah wants to, just a quick wrap up, He wants us to grow. He wants us to get out of our comfort zone. He wants to encourage and motivate us. And He wants to raise awareness and consciousness within us through each blessing. Each blessing is a sign that is meant to lead us somewhere. And it is important for us to recognize what that sign is pointing toward. That's all the time that we have for today's episode of The Lantern. Thank you for being with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
ألا بذكر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. General Qasem Soleimani was a high-ranking Iranian military official whose popularity began to rise after he led the war on Daesh terrorists on the battlefields in Syria and Iraq. General Qasem Soleimani was the commander of Iran's Quds Force, the foreign arm